You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
It is Wednesday, February 24th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor, author of The System, Who Rigged It, How to Fix It, and on more. Meanwhile, COVID vaccine firms pledge to ramp up the dosages. Meanwhile, a variant in California looks more dangerous after more study. House to pass the COVID relief bill on Friday. Some conservative Democrats in the Senate want to cut the minimum wage. Others to more precisely target state aid. Meanwhile, the Republican Senate already determined to offer zero votes for any COVID relief. Zero votes. Joe Biden to call the Saudi king on the eve of a damning report, the Khashoggi killing. A retired New York City cop charged in the Capitol riot. He's the one who beat another police officer. I think it was the American flag. No criminal charges in the killing of Daniel Prude. Meanwhile, new tapes show how LA sheriffs created the conflict before shooting to death Kurt Reinhold over alleged jaywalking. Illinois, first state to eliminate cash bail. Amazon spending $25 million to bust an Alabama union. Bernie Sanders reveals that a major infrastructure bill is in the works and Democrats are planning on reconciliation for that one, too. All this and more on today's program. Oh, there's Emma. I just realized what's going on here today. We did not call each other and say, let's wear our white shirts and you wear your glasses today. Mm-hmm. This feels like almost like some type of like Halloween prank.
Well, you know, we didn't call each other. You called me and you said, this is the uniform now. And if you don't like it, you're out of a job. And that's kind of the way you roll.
we've been talking on this for an hour and it didn't even occur to me that we were basically dressed as twins. We may have to. Can we fix that in editing? Can we fix that in post-production where we maybe put a little color into your shirt or into mine or something like that?
Yeah.
Add stripes or something?
Well, it's an issue because I'm starting to mispronounce things like you, and now I'm starting to dress like you. We talk too often during the day, I think.
That is the that's part of the employee handbook. So you gotta end up doing that. Hilarious. I didn't even realize that. I'm starting to look at like getting chats from people and there it is. Let's get right into this because I can't wait to talk to Robert Reich. It's been way too long. On Tuesday, we missed this yesterday. Today is Wednesday. On Tuesday, Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, who is going to be facing a tough election in Wisconsin in 19 months, in 2022. He is desperate to make sure that he has shored up his bona fides with the Republican Trump base. That's redundant, but nevertheless, in Wisconsin. And you combine that with Ron Johnson being, you know, supposedly, and who are we to judge, a guy who doesn't have the firmest grasp on, well, I don't know about reality, but he's not, let's put it this way, he's not known as an intellectual giant of the Senate. And no,
and I just wanted to add quickly, he's up for re-election despite coming into power promising that he would not run for more than two terms, and now he's up for his third term. So also a documented liar in many respects.
Well, I'm sure circumstances have changed. Here is Ron Johnson at the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, using his time for questioning the Capitol security folks to push a blatant conspiracy theory.
Thousands of people I passed or who passed me along Constitution Avenue, some were indignant and contemptuous of Congress, but not one appeared angry or incited to riot. Many of the marchers were families with small children. Many were elderly, overweight, or just plain tired or frail. Traits not typically attributed to the riot prone. Many wore pro-police shirts.
Oh, pause or carried pro-police. I'm sorry. Did he say overweight?
Yeah.
Can we start that again? Is he saying that overweight people cannot be rioters? That is impressive.
Yeah. Well, unless you're Antifa, then you can be all shapes and sizes and even not Antifa in Ron Johnson's mind.
Let's run that back again. I wonder, like, who overweight? Where was that theory from?
But not one appeared angry or incited to riot. Many of the marchers were families with small children. Many were elderly, overweight, or just plain tired or frail. Traits not typically attributed to the riot prone. Many wore pro-police shirts.
Sorry, pause it. I just have to say it's like Abercrombie. You know how in the past they were under fire for having attractiveness metrics for their employees. That's it's the same handbook for rioters.
The riot prone.
You got to be in shape, and you got to look good. You got to have yourself put together, but go ahead.
Elderly, overweight, or just plain tired or frail. Traits not typically attributed to the riot prone. Many wore pro-police shirts or carried pro-police black and blue flags. Although the crowd represented a broad cross-section of Americans, mostly working class by their appearance and manner of speech, some people stood out. A very few didn't share the jovial, friendly, earnest demeanor of the great majority. Some obviously didn't fit in, and he describes four different types of people: plainclothes militants, agents provocateurs, fake Trump protesters, and then disciplined uniformed column of attackers. I think these are the people that probably planned this. He goes on, the D.C. Metropolitan Police were their usual professionally detached selves, standing on curbs or at street crossings and exchanging an occasional greeting for marchers. When we crossed First Street Northwest to enter the Capitol grounds where the Capitol Police had jurisdiction, I noticed no police at all. Several marchers expressed surprise. The openness seemed like a courtesy gesture from Congress, which controls security.
So let's just be clear on what he's saying here. One, he's saying that the Capitol rioters were not, or were suspiciously different from the other pro-Trump protesters. And it was also suspicious as if the Capitol Police were ushering people in, particularly these. I mean, this is really nutso in many respects, in every respect, I would say, completely nuts. Now, we do know who the Capitol rioters are, or at least we have a good sense of them. Last week on Tuesday, I think it was, I spoke to Robert Pape, who has been studying these people based upon after extensive interviews with them and with interviews that were done by police of people who were arrested. Go back and check that out last Tuesday. He's done some amazing work, and they've done this before with ISIS fighters and others. So we know who they were, and they're not at all as Ron Johnson is characterizing. We just also know today that a former New York City police officer who was on the mayoral detail before he retired, was one of the guys arrested for being for basically brutalizing one of the Capitol police officers. So,
well, I mean, and I think that action might cancel out the pro police shirts that he was seeing, the actual assault of police officers. That so quickly Republicans flip on their Blue Lives Matter stuff and their pro police talk when they can peddle a pro, you know, Trump conspiracy theory that absolves Republican senators of their complicity in this insurrection attempt. That's really what he was floating there. It's like, oh, maybe the Capitol Police were ushering them in. Can you imagine if a Democrat was making those same? I mean, Democrats are way too afraid to make those same arguments, and Johnson's are obviously unfounded.
Totally unfounded. But I wonder if he walks off that out of that Senate chamber and says, "I just got an extra half a point in my general election in 2022." All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Robert Reich on the occasion of the paperback version of the system, who rigged it and how to fix it. It is White Shirt Wednesday here. We will see what he's wearing. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report on the Zoom. And we'd like him, if he could, to turn on his video so that we can see him.
So that we can see if he's also wearing a white shirt.
There we go. It is
much like us.
Want to welcome back to the program Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor, the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and a senior fellow at the Blum Center, and of course the author of his most recent, I think, of 19 books, if I'm not mistaken, The System, Who Rigged It, How to Fix It. Robert Reich, welcome back to the program. It's great to see you.
Well, good morning, Sam, and good morning, Emma. How are you this morning?
Doing well, a little bit relieved to see that you're not wearing a white shirt. Emma and I accidentally dressed exactly alike today, and so I hope that's not too distracting.
No, well, I got the instructions from your producer to wear a white shirt, but I don't have any.
Yes, well, you're a renegade. I mean, the thing about it is Sam's trying to make it seem like he didn't direct me to dress in this uniform, and off camera, Brendan is also wearing a white shirt and glasses.
Yeah, this I'm sure. Well, they're, you know, here on the West Coast, nobody has a white shirt. It's very hard to find them.
I understand.
Yeah, it's not cool. It's not cool.
All right. Well, let's start with the premise of your book. I mean, and I want to talk about your book, but I also want to talk about, you know, this book. You wrote this book. It came out, I believe, just on the verge of the beginning of the pandemic, and so much has happened, and the response, I think, in many respects, reflects your premise of your book, and maybe on some level, you know, any response would on some level, but there's other things I want to talk about. But let's talk about the premise of your book, which is that there is, or one of those premises is, there is a false debate that we engage in that obscures the real dynamic that is happening in this country.
Yes. And the real dynamic is not the old traditional left versus right, or the Republicans versus Democrats, or, you know, all of the dichotomies that we're traditionally used to. The real division underlying everything is between democracy and what I call oligarchy. It's a good old-fashioned Greek word meaning ruled by a small number of people who have most of the money and most of the political power.
And so let's I'd like to think that the audience at this point is familiar with the term, but why don't you walk us through what constitutes an oligarchy, and maybe, like, at what point do you perceive that we became one?
Well, we have been an oligarchy. I mean, the founding fathers were, in a sense, an oligarchy, a small group of landed elites, well-educated, who decided basically on how the country was going to be organized. Democracy started prevailing. More and more people had a direct vote. We had an oligarchy again in the late 1900s, really in the late kind of 1890, rather, the kind of Gilded Age. We had a group of people who were, we called them robber barons. They ran the country. They had most of the wealth, most of the power. And now, once again, we have something like an oligarchy. That is a few people, relatively few people, who I don't want to suggest that it's a conspiracy. That word is used too much. It's just that more and more of our wealth as a nation, more and more of the power of government, is in the hands of a fairly few people. I mean, 660 billionaires in the United States right now. Since the start of the pandemic, they've earned their wealth has grown $1.3 trillion since the start of the pandemic. I mean, 660 people, they've grown $1.3 trillion. They could actually give every American $3,800, including every child, and still be as well off as they were at the start of the pandemic. I mean, we've never seen this degree of wealth. And we end up fighting among ourselves. That is, Democrats, Republicans, people who are working class, people who are working class whites, people who are, people of color. Everybody is sort of thinking that it's the other guy or the other people who are their adversaries in some weird way, when in fact, everybody's fighting over the crumbs.
Well, you mentioned the Gilded Age there, right? So can we zoom out a little bit and talk about the breakdown of monopoly power from that era and maybe how that informs the lens with which we view the current oligarchy and moneyed interests that are dominating our politics and our economic way of life? Because obviously there was a breakdown. There was an increase in antitrust and a recognition that these powers have grown too large, and our system was rigged in a way. Can you talk about that from a historical context?
Sure, Emma. If you go back to the first Gilded Age, and again, it's about 1890 to 1900 and thereabouts, we had in a few industries, and I'm talking about railroads, oil, and steel, and finance, people who ran the country, essentially. I mean, Andrew Carnegie, in terms of his steel mills, and Cornelius Vanderbilt, in terms of big railroads, and John D. Rockefeller, in terms of his Standard Oil Trust. I mean, these people, not only did they run the country, not only did they have huge wealth, but they suppressed wages. They fought the beginnings of unionization. They kept a lot of workers in poverty. They corrupted government because their money, the lackeys of the very, very wealthy deposited sacks of money on the desks of pliant legislators. I mean, that's how bad it got. And it wasn't until the beginnings of the 20th century that in the progressive era, interesting, we used that term, years ago, before we used it contemporaneously, there was a kind of a reaction. And one of the pieces of reaction was antitrust. That was fighting the monopolies, trying to get rid of those gigantic Standard Oil Trusts and the Carnegies and the gigantic railroad monopolies. That because they were monopolies, they had inordinate power to charge whatever they wanted, to basically make everybody else's life miserable because everybody was paying much higher prices than necessary, and also to use a lot of that money to pay off politicians.
I'm still trying to absorb the idea that 660 people made $1.3 trillion over the past 12 months. I mean, it's astonishing.
Sam, it's astonishing. What's also astonishing is that we don't talk about it very much. That is, we're talking, in Congress, you hear everybody saying, well, how can we afford $1.9 trillion that Joe Biden wants for this rescue plan to give, everybody basically what they desperately need in this country? We've got millions, tens of millions of people who are in trouble. And that's $1.9 trillion. And then 660 people, since the start of the pandemic, have gained, in terms of their wealth, which was already huge, they've gained $1.3 trillion. I mean, that's two-thirds of what Biden's entire plan is worth. That's what's so extraordinary, that we don't talk about it, we don't recognize it, it's not something that is on the top of our minds. This is a huge change in the structure of our economy and also power.
But is it a huge change, or is it an enhancement of a dynamic that has already existed, right? I mean, because everything you're saying now, you said 13 months ago, and obviously at one point, the concentration of this type of wealth also concentrates the power, of course, and so it gets the dynamic gets more enhanced. But I guess what I'm getting at is the concept of oligarchy, right? And I know you mentioned Brandeis as having given us a warning. I guess it was about 100 years ago, which is you can't have both this type of wealth concentration, I'm paraphrasing, and a democracy. You get to choose, essentially. Is that an indication that when we talk about the system being rigged, maybe it's not a bug of the system that it's rigged? Maybe it's a feature of the system that, you know, as you know, Thomas Piketty I've lost sense of time, but that we've actually returned to the mean in this type of structure of our economy, where we have such consolidation of wealth, as opposed to this being some type of divergence from how the system works. In other words, do we have a systemic problem that is with the system rather than the fact that it's been rigged?
Well, that's a good question. And if you look at the 30 years after the Second World War, the answer would be, no, it's not a systemic problem. In fact, we created in those years, 30 years after the Second World War, the largest middle class the world had ever seen. And not only did we create that large middle class, but almost everybody, including the poorest Americans, were doing better and better and better and better year after year. Almost everybody was sharing the gains. And we were moving toward not perfect equality. We would never get there. We should never try to achieve perfect equality. But we were actually moving toward equality of opportunity. The Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, new opportunities for women. We really did, as a nation, commit ourselves to the proposition that huge money and huge wealth at the top should not be the dominating feature of American life. And we were winning. And then there was a big U-turn starting in around 1981 and I'm not going to blame Ronald Reagan, but it was not coincidental. That was also a time of the big kind of unfriendly, hostile takeovers. Wall Street started exercising its muscle, and we went from what might be considered stakeholder capitalism, in which corporations really did exist not just for their shareholders, but for really their workers and their communities, to shareholder capitalism. And I think that really was the beginning of the end of widespread prosperity in America.
But I guess my point is, and you're talking about that era that sometimes people refer to as the Great Compression, that was the anomaly. That if you look at the span of American history, that period was the anomaly. That in fact we didn't really commit ourselves to those principles, because we gave them up rather quickly, it appears, as a nation, and that having an awareness that there's something problematic about the system in and of itself that is so susceptible to being rigged, that maybe it's a problem with the system rather than the riggers, as it were.
Well, I'm sure that there is some truth to that, and I talk about that at length in the book. But that view, Sam, that basically the system is inherently rigged and inherently predisposed to oligarchy, that's a fairly bleak assessment. What does that leave you with? That leaves you with saying, well, there's nothing really ultimately we can do. I prefer to say there is a lot we can do, that we've had periods of time, such as I just referred to, that is the three decades of the Second World War, and there are other periods of time where we actually did generate much more equal opportunity, where we created possibilities for real democracy. We never really got there, but we could. I prefer to have that point of view rather than looking at the 30 years after the Second World War as an anomaly, just because that's my temperament. And also, when I teach, you know, I've been teaching young people in college for about 35 years. I want them to be as idealistic as they are right now. In fact, the young people I'm teaching right now, between the ages of 18 and 24, are probably as committed to public service, to changing the country, to making the place America better, to making the world better, as any generation I have come across in my 35 years of teaching. So I'm not going to say to them, oh, well, give up, because it's just an anomaly. The system is essentially rigged, and there's nothing you can do about it.
I want
them to be on the front lines. I want them to be changing this country.
I don't mean to say that I'm not presenting this as a fatalistic view. I'm talking about when we talk about solutions, if we diagnose the problem as being somewhat systemic, as opposed to something that's acting upon the system, then the prescription changes, right? If we perceive this as there is a inherent problem with capitalism, that it will always return to the mean because there is too much of what is available in our society that can be commodified, then we are creating sources of money making and power that are too easily concentrated. As opposed to the idea that maybe this is just a question of semantics, but it does seem to me to say that the prescription might be to decommodify those areas where we see these concentrations of power. So that may be in the healthcare sector, in the energy sector, maybe even in the finance sector to some extent.
And in high tech. Absolutely. I think antitrust is very important and relevant. That is, taking on these big centers of economic power and either busting them up directly or indirectly. That is, you know, with the big high tech firms, you could just say, we as the nation need you, and we are going to order you under antitrust law because you dominate. You're too big. You are too dominating to share your algorithms or share your software or, you know, license others to use it as well, so that we're just not faced with these centers of private power as we now have. Or we could do the same thing with the big banks. You know, in 2008, when we had the financial crisis, the five biggest banks on Wall Street, they had something in the order of 30% of all the financial assets in the United States. And that's a lot. Now, today, the five biggest banks are much bigger. They have 44% of all the financial assets, and they're far too big to fail. And that's what, you know, that gets back to the Brandeis. Justice Brandeis, about 120 years ago, said, essentially, we do have a choice in this country. We can either have vast wealth in the hands of a few, or we can have a democracy, but we can't have both. And that Brandeisian view, if you will, I think is still as relevant, if not more relevant today. I hope Joe Biden chooses people to head his antitrust division of the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission who will really take on monopolies and monopoly power.
And what do you think about that question of decommodifying certain aspects of what we need to live, so that there isn't, certainly there's, I think, and I'm a strong proponent of antitrust, and I think there's many areas where we need this, but I'm not sure. I mean, because we keep saying like we can do this, but we can't necessarily. Like there are from your perspective, are there sectors, and antitrust may be one solution to some of these sectors, but are there sectors that you think we should be focusing on to decommodify that will weaken the grip that money has on our politics?
Absolutely. We'll take the healthcare sector, which you mentioned. I mean, a lot of people don't remember this or they don't know it, but in the 1940s and 1950s, health insurance was nonprofit. And we had Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and that was basically it. And nobody even thought of making health insurance into a commodity, into a private for-profit commodity. Maybe that was better. In fact, I think there's a lot of reason to believe that it was making it kind of not-for-profit really worked better for the people. And once you had these big, giant for-profit companies taking in and taking over health insurance, then they started dropping people with pre-existing conditions. They started segmenting the market. They started using advertising and marketing, spending gigantic amounts of money on advertising and marketing. So yes, you are right. I think that we can decommodify, if you want to use that term, takes in certain industries where there are public consequences and public goods so critically important and make them into kind of not-for-profit entities.
Well, you mentioned Louis Brandeis and the role of the courts in the antitrust era that kind of brought about, you know, more progressive economics. And the issue with our current system is that we have an ultra conservative Supreme Court, right? As opposed to back then. What challenges do you see as presented by the fact that our Supreme Court has been stacked with conservatives and even lower courts as well? Because legal challenges might be a lot harder in this era.
Well, Emma, I think you're right. Legal challenges will be harder to some extent. I've been pleasantly surprised that the Trump appointees to the Supreme Court have not seemed, in some very important cases over the last year, they have not seemed to side with Republicans or with Trump, for that matter. I mean, look at the case that just they just decided in terms of access to his tax records. So you can't predict exactly how the courts are going to go. We do know from history, though. We've been talking about Louis Brandeis. Louis Brandeis was on the Supreme Court, but we know that the courts of the 1930s, when Franklin D. Roosevelt was trying to do a lot of experimental big things in terms of the New Deal, trying to break the grip of the old oligarchy, we know that the courts were on the side of the oligarchy in those days. And it wasn't until 1937 when he threatened to expand the number of justices on the court and make the court a little bit more representative of the people, that the court changed its tune. There's a lot of historic kind of uncertainty about why exactly the court did that, but then it became much more amenable to Franklin D. Roosevelt and to the New Deal. Well, we'll see. I don't know. We don't have enough evidence yet exactly how this new court, or even the judiciary that's been, we can say, packed by Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell over the last 4 years. Huge number of lower court judges are now Republicans, appointees. But it's not clear that they are going to buck legislation that expands democracy against oligarchy. I think really the biggest issue is big money in politics. I think that's the hardest nut to crack. Getting big corporations and super PACs and the wealthy stopping the flow, extraordinary amounts of money that are now flowing into elections and into lobbying and into all sorts of public and so-called public interest campaigns to convince the public that what the big corporations want is good for them.
Well, I mean, let's talk about that. And we can also sort of bring in Jamie Dimon, because he is, in some respects, in the book, your bete noire, and certainly a good choice of one. But he's also a big Democratic donor, and not just being a donor. I mean, I think, like, you know, one of the things I think that Donald Trump showed us is that it's not necessarily the actual cash in the context of an election. There's also, it's about cash and it's about access to politicians. And it's also about, frankly, just sort of like the waters, if you will, that politicians swim in. And, you know, Jamie Dimon He gives money, but it's not, I don't think that's what gets him the access. I think what gets him the access is he's part of this elite class, that there is a presumption that, you know, and I think Barack Obama sort of, you know, surrounded himself with Reubenites, who, and there was a presumption that they all knew what they were talking about with the financial crisis. And what they ended up doing was creating a much slower recovery and creating really millions of people whose homes were foreclosed because they trusted the banks as being the sort of the best. As long as you take care of the banks, they'll take care of everybody else. And it turned out, well, that's not really the case. They're going to take care of themselves.
Well, one of the biggest mistakes, Sam, that the Democratic presidents, particularly Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, made was courting Wall Street and putting Wall Streeters into their administration as secretaries of Treasury and so on. I think Biden has not made that mistake, or at least as conspicuously as as did Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. I mean, Janet Yellen is not a creature of Wall Street. She really is talking and acting and thinking very differently from the way Wall Street is talking and acting traditionally. So I have hopes there. But I do think it is very important that the public pay attention to what's now called H.R. 1. It's the first bill in the House, also S.1, the first bill in the Senate. But Democrats in both the House and the Senate have put forward campaign finance reform, which is, there's a limit to what you can do as long as you have Citizens United, that Supreme Court case there, and you can't just wave a magic wand and get rid of Citizens United. But you can do a lot, those first particular bills in this new Congress are very important in terms of containing the poisonous flow of big money into politics.
But is it, I mean, I guess the other way of doing that, and I don't mean to sort of keep returning to this, and I agree with you on Janet Yellen. She had a great quote, I think it was just yesterday or the day before, where she said, you can target relief to people, but you're inevitably going to miss pockets of pain if you worry about targeting, as opposed to just sort of getting the money out there with as wide of a spigot as you can. But, you know, one of the other ways of, and because we're so limited by Citizens United and Buckley v. Valeo and the entire sort of like the case law that has been developed around that impairs the ability to curtail money going in, is to just sort of prevent people from getting this much money. Part of that is antitrust. It's and I think part of it is that type of commodification, and I think part of it is more robust financial regulations. And really, I mean, actively limit the ability for people to amass this kind of wealth.
You're pushing on an open door right here. I mean, but it's a chicken and egg problem, a gigantic chicken and egg problem.
Right.
Because, you know, in order to get the political will and the political power to raise taxes on the wealthy or to decommodify part of our economy or to do all of the things, or antitrust, all of the things we're talking about, you've got to get big money out of politics so that the politicians have that kind of courage. I was one of the harshest critics, and still am, of Donald Trump and the current Republican Party. But I also took note of the fact that most Trump followers are non-college graduates. Many of these people have not had a raise in 40 years, to the extent that they have been in the workforce for 40 years. I mean, the typical American has taken it on the chin while more and more of the gains of the economy have gone to the very top. Now, Donald Trump, you know, it persuaded people he was going to be a great hero of the working class. He obviously wasn't. He gave big corporations and the wealthy exactly what they wanted in terms of tax cuts and regulatory rollbacks. But the point is that there is a political void right now. Nobody is out there representing the American working class. The Democrats abandoned the working class, not just the white working class, but the working class. And I think this is an opportunity, talking about gigantic chicken and eggs, it's an opportunity for the Democrats to regain their traditional position, their traditional Franklin D. Roosevelt position as the champions of the working class. And they've got to do it. You know, raise the minimum wage. What's stopping them from raising the minimum wage? Nothing.
right now, Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, but maybe they can be maybe they can be convinced with I don't know, a civic center somewhere in West Virginia.
Sam,
maybe.
if Lyndon Johnson could shake literally the shoulders of Southern Democrats and say, "Join me in the Civil Rights Act," then certainly Joe Biden can win over Joe Manchin to a minimum wage. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that a president cannot do that.
Well, it's a question of will on Biden's end.
Yes,
view. Yes,
absolutely.
Let me ask. So let's turn to what we saw during the course of the pandemic in terms of response, the CARES Act in particular, because the CARES Act seemed to it certainly helped extreme poverty in this country. It took millions of people out of poverty for a certain period of time because, you know, including like the extra benefit on the unemployment insurance and direct payments. But it also opened the floodgates for a tremendous amount of basically free money for, free loans, essentially, for corporate America, allowing 660 people and others to amass massive fortunes during this time. Can you break that down for us a little?
Yeah, well, there are several aspects of what happened in the CARES Act and what Congress has actually done up until now that should trouble a lot of us. I mean, there was, for example, the Fed and the Treasury Department forgave all the loans. I mean, talk about this is kind of it puts student loan forgiveness in context. I mean, they forgave a lot of the big debts that a lot of corporations had amassed over the previous 10 years, because they wanted to make sure that the corporations didn't go under and the corporations could continue to employ people during the pandemic. Well, that kind of loan forgiveness, essentially buying up those loans, which had essentially they were junk loans. I mean, remember, corporations over the last 10 years have borrowed huge amounts of money. What have they done with the money? They've not given workers better jobs. They've basically taken the money and bought back their shares of stock to give the stock market a kind of artificial high. So the first thing they did, I mean, the Treasury Department and the Fed, was to get this kind of corporate loan forgiveness program, which has not got nearly the attention it deserves.
Can you explain the mechanics of that? I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but I'm curious about that aspect, because my understanding was that the Treasury had basically provided the capital, or I should say the capital reserves, to allow the Fed to make loans. But explain to me the mechanics of that loan forgiveness, because I haven't heard much about that either.
Yeah, because the Fed buys back the bonds of the big corporations. And a lot of those bonds had, because of the pandemic and because of the economy fell off a cliff last March, a lot of those bonds became basically junk bonds. And so what happened was that these corporations had taken a huge risk for the years leading up to the pandemic in terms of becoming laden with debt so that they could buy back their own shares of stock. It was a huge risk. And then the pandemic came along and those loans to those corporations basically became junk bonds because they were worth so little, and the corporations were in a lot of corporations would not have been able to pay back those loans. The Treasury Department and the Fed bought the loans back, basically saying, "Don't worry about it. You know, don't worry about it. We're here. We will."
And so, are those loans on the Fed's books? Like, how do they get rid of those?
Well, the loans are there on the Fed's books. In fact, they're just like what the Fed has done for years, starting in 2008, 2009, with the financial crisis, in terms of buying up corporate loans, essentially, and keeping interest rates very low. I mean, I'm not suggesting there's a conspiracy here. This is right. Not anything that is bad, but it just didn't get very much publicity because you start talking about the finance and people's eyes glaze over. And unfortunately, when you talk about student loan forgiveness, people do pay attention, but it's complicated. It's hard to do. When you talk about, the increase in the 660 billionaires' wealth over the past 10 months of $1.3 trillion. People can't even envision what $1.3 trillion is. You know, how many zeros is 1.3 trillion. But when you talk about giving, you know, $1,400 per person in a check, people understand that, but yet politically it becomes very difficult to do. That's one of the paradoxes we are living in right now, Sam.
When you, from your experience in the Clinton administration, do you have a sense of what are there key cabinet positions when you talk about implementing these things? And I imagine each administration is different in terms of the way that people advise the president and who the president might have different relationships with. But are there key personnel decisions that you perceive that, like, when you're looking at who Biden's choosing, are there individuals or specific roles that you say, this is really important that we have someone here as opposed to someone there? Like, okay.
Well, the Treasury Secretary is really the most important in terms of economic policy. But what we've been talking about goes beyond economic policy. It's really a structure of the economy as a whole. The head of the National Economic Council, which, interestingly, Congress does not have to confirm. It is a presidential appointment. The National Economic Council was created by Bill Clinton, and that person really is a key player in all of this. The Council of Economic Advisers, somewhat less so. OMB director can be very, very important. Those are the key figures. The rest of the cabinet, you know, obviously the Justice Department is very important,
right?
In certain respects, antitrust law enforcement, but I've named just about all of the key important players.
And the Council of Economic Advisers, I think the Biden administration is going to raise the head of that to a cabinet position, or at least going to be advising more directly. And I know there's a couple of probably former colleagues of yours, I think, who are sitting on that. But OMB, it appears right now that, and we've spoken about Yellen, it appears that in OMB, Neera Tanden's nomination is all but dead. I think they just postponed her hearing or the vote on her. The names I have seen floated, one of them reported by a couple outlets, is Jean Sperling. Jean Sperling was in the Clinton administration. Some have written that the Jean Sperling of that day is different than the Jean Sperling of today. Give me your assessment.
Oh, I'm a great fan of Jean. He's a close friend. We've worked together since 1988 in and out of various administrations and on all sorts of projects. I think he'd do an excellent job. There are other people in the administration who are there already who are not getting maybe not the attention they deserve, but are also doing very, very important work. Jared Bernstein, who's on the Council of Economic Advisors, really has he worked with me at the Labor Department 100 years ago, a very important and I think a great progressive voice who understands the issues really, really well. There are a number of others, and I have a lot of confidence in them. And, you know, I want to give credit where credit is due. Biden is listening to them. I mean, that $1.9 trillion bill that's now working its way this week through the House and then next week through the Senate, hopefully, that has some extraordinary progressive ideas and proposals in it with regard to child poverty, for example, with regard to expanding the earned income tax credit. Another thing that makes people's eyes glaze over, you know, you want people to go to sleep, you say earned income tax credit, and they go to sleep. Very important. The largest anti-poverty program in the federal government today is the earned income tax credit. So these things are there in that $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill.
Are you struck I saw a piece today that said, centrist Democrats eye state aid, and I thought I was going to read into this piece that they were looking to cut state aid. But in fact, it appeared, at least from the reporting, that they were responding to claims by governors that they were going to get that money and they were going to cut taxes for presumably the wealthy in their state. And they wanted to direct that money so that the state didn't have the same discretion necessarily to use it to cut taxes. Are you surprised by the complete sort of lack of, I don't know how to express this, policy response from the Republicans to this $1.9 trillion? I mean, they say vaguely, it seems too big for what we need now, but there's no talk of deficit. There's no talk of debt. Do you think that's a function of COVID, or do you think that's a function of they're just like, you know, they run out of it.
No, Sam, I think it's a function of Trump. The Republican Party has become the Trump Party, and there is no message. They are not capable of generating any kind of coherent message other than defending or adulating or embracing or expressing their determination to protect Donald Trump. You know, claiming that the election was a fraud. I mean, this is a huge problem for the Republican Party. In the short term, it's a great benefit for the Democrats because, as we are now talking, there is no Republican message at all. There's no capacity to create a Republican message. This Sunday, Donald Trump is going to be re-inaugurated, in effect, as the head of the Republican Party at CPAC. I don't know if Mitt Romney yesterday said something very interesting, was not picked up on very much. Yeah. Mitt Romney talked about the tiny sliver of the Republican Party that he is part of, that represents his thinking. The tiny sliver. I mean, the Republican Party is nothing. It's gone. Poof. It's dead.
Yes. Well, let's hope that the Democrats don't necessarily move to the right to fill that vacuum. I mean, that is, you know, one of the concerns, you know, and I guess, but the $1.9 trillion is at least, I think, a step in the right direction. I guess we will see. And I hope that President Biden can convince Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema on that $15 minimum wage. I'm sure also they have the ability to do so with the parliamentarian to get this through reconciliation. But
well, it's a very tiny window of opportunity they now face. I think that they, you know, we're not talking about this enough either. I mean, November of 2022 is right around the corner. That's the midterms. And, you know, to have the presidency and essential control over both houses of Congress is a rarity. I mean, it happened for the first 2 years of the Clinton administration, first 2 years of the Biden administration. Over the last 28 years, it's 4 years. And if you don't do what you want to do or need to do or what the nation needs to do in these little windows of opportunity, you're not going to have it. It's going to be gone.
Robert Reich, the book is called The System, Who Rigged It, How to Fix It. Can't tell you enough how much I appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it.
Well, thank you very much, Sam. Emma, very nice to see you.
Nice to see you as well. Thanks so much.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Professor did not wear his white shirt today, but maybe next time. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back. All our white Wednesdays. Is that what we're calling these shirts? What is it? White Shirt Wednesdays?
Yeah, maybe include the shirt in there. Jeez.
Yeah, you that's gotta
probably do that. Yes. It's interesting to me that Robert Reich, I think, is very progressive. He was a supporter of Bernie Sanders. I don't know how he would identify himself in terms of as a democratic socialist or whatnot. And I think at one point you do bump up against this question of how is it that when we return to the mean of this system is oligarchic. And what do you need to do to make sure that we do not revert to it? I mean, even if we were to get to a place where we got to following World War II, how do you make sure that we do not revert? How do you maintain that tension? One of the ways I think was lost was that dynamic of the relevance of money in our politics. And one of the ways to inhibit that, based upon the structure that we have now in terms of our laws and our case law, seems to me, is to diminish the concentration of that wealth. And the way you do that is through confiscatory taxing, frankly. I think Bernie Sanders had a proposal that, like, we're going to tax 90 cents on the dollar of every dollar that a billionaire made during the pandemic. Not a bad idea. There's $1.3 trillion out there made undoubtedly by people who really see no material difference in their lives whatsoever from the making of that $1.3 trillion. If you were wealthy enough to position yourself to make that kind of money, 660 people before the pandemic, you don't, except for maybe a couple more zeros, on the statements that you get that presumably someone comes in and tells you in the morning or whatever. I don't have a sense of how that works, but I have a feeling it's something like another $500 million today, sir or ma'am.
Well, I mean, these billionaires are so obsessive about their wealth. I'm sure they're checking their net worth and their portfolio at every waking moment.
That's the one
thing they don't need an assistant for.
But the point being, that's the only way that they would know. It wouldn't mean like, oh, I can finally buy those other 45 houses that I wanted to buy, at the ski resort or wherever it is. Confiscatory taxes and decommodifying some of the major sectors of power, of where money is made, seems to me to be the best recipe for maintaining that system if you want to maintain it. But we will talk more about this in the coming days, Emma. As you know, hopefully tomorrow we'll wear different shirts and maybe we'll get different eyewear.
Maybe.
We'll see you tomorrow. And for those of you who are sticking around, we're not going to. We are actually going to make a commitment now to wear the same color shirts every day and have the same glasses.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I've been noticing that I was like having headaches and I hadn't been wearing my glasses. I especially need it when I look at screens. And so I was like, I'm doing it today. I have to. And what do you know?
There you go. And I have this problem now that like I'm close to a window and my glasses are turning dark, and it's like a Howard Stern look. I'm getting that. I have two pairs of glasses. I have one that doesn't do this, and I'll go like weeks with one pair of glasses and weeks with the other, and I forget.
What are those called? Those things.
Transition lenses.
Ah.
Back in my comedy days, I did do a bit where a character who I was trying to make seem completely ineffectual had a pair of glasses where one side would go dark when he was indoors. And so it was always, it was tough to pull off.
Yeah.
I had to execute that on the budget of the show that we had. So if you are doing you're doing some type of entertainment program or a short film and you have the budget to do that, take that idea. There you go. I'd love to see it executed properly.
I mean, you should be copywriting it, but sure.
Well, I mean, it's for me, it's the ideas out there, and that's the way these things go. We're going to head into the fun half in just a moment. I just want to remind everybody that this program relies on your support. When you become a member, you not only support the free show, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but we also give you the fun half. And then you also get the bragging rights. I can't guarantee that's always going to come, you can go and tell your family, you guys aren't a member of the Majority Report. Maybe some of them might know what you're talking about. Probably not, but
flex on them.
If you do it with confidence, people are going to think like, oh gosh, she's so much better than us, or he's so much better than us. He's a member of the Majority Report. She's a member of the Majority Report. So
yeah,
you got that going for you. Also,
like
don't forget,
like the stream,
justcoffee.coop. Yeah, like the stream on YouTube, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Don't forget the AM quickie. On Nomi's show today, I don't know who's going to be on Nomi's show today. It is, but you can check it out at youtube.com/the Nomi Key Show or twitch.tv/the_NomiKey_show.
Mm.
And check that out. And also check out the Antifada. They're Twitch streaming, I think, 3 or 4 days a week now. And also you can find them at patreon.com. And Matt, I don't know what Matt's doing. He's on vacation, but he's probably streaming. He's probably like flying over, some part of North Dakota, I don't know, reading some type of like 18th century literature that he is recording because nobody has put it on tape. So I don't know. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back in the fun half.
and for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious.